I'm joined once again by old friend and ultra-talented Chicago improv and sketch comedy actor, Joey Bland. I called you a sketch comedy actor, but I don't know if that's actually true. I threw that out there, but when's the last time you did any sketch stuff?
Last night.
Oh, all right. Well, then it is true, and I stand by it.
I worked with Second City for some time, and so most of what we do in there is just sketch. So I'm doing a Second City show these days. So you can call me a sketch comedy actor.
Well, I of course knew, because I've seen it, that you have done sketch. I just didn't know if you were currently doing a Second City show or not.
I am.
Tell me a little bit about that, because I'm genuinely interested. Plus, anyone who listens to this can find out a little bit about your Second City work.
Well, sure. The show that I'm doing now, though, is extremely niche. It's all part of the... You're familiar with the original project in some way, but the Second City... allied itself with the Chicago Lyric Opera, which is the opera, hoity-toity, all that, the big opera house of Chicago. And we did a one-night gala in January to a lot of acclaim, selling out the opera house and basically getting on stage and doing a series of sketches that sort of synced up but also celebrated opera and played in that kind of idiom. And we had some opera singers in the show. Patrick Stewart hosted that event. And anyway, it was a huge hit, and so they decided to flip it and make it into a full run. It was going to only be the one night event, and so for the month of June we're doing it 6 nights a week on a smaller scale instead of selling out the opera house and actually performing for the actual 4,000 seat house. They've built essentially a cabaret theater on the stage.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so it's basically a theater bigger than Second City on the opera stage, and people come and see the show. That it's in large part the same as it was in January, with a little bit of different new material and altered material, and no Patrick Stewart and no celebrities.
I was going to say, Patrick Stewart probably not showing up for every performance, I would think.
That is correct.
Too busy working with improvised Shakespeare at this point.
That's right. So that was the crushing blow, was that I developed a relationship with Patrick Stewart during that Second City show, parlayed that into a guest appearance he made with an improv group that I'm a part of, the Improvised Shakespeare Company in New York City. He got bit by the improv bug, contacted us, and was like, I got to play again. And so was invited to play on a May 31st home show, which was the opening preview of the remount of the Second City's Guide to the Opera. So I was doing the preview for the show that he had formally launched with Second City and the Opera, while he was playing with my improv group. It was extremely complicated. And then I'll say that on the night he was performing with the Improvised Shakespeare Company in Chicago and blowing all the minds of people who showed up for that, I was doing a sketch comedy show.
Bottom line, you are a victim of your own success. I always like to phrase it that way. It makes it sound better for you.
It's a win-win.
I'm not sure it's a win-win, but I am glad that Martin got to play with Patrick Stewart, because we talked about that the first time that happened, which I was lucky enough to actually attend that, and because you were kind enough to kind of let me in on the surprise ahead of time, because otherwise I wouldn't have randomly been up in New York City.
You would have taken a $350 train ride.
Yeah, I wouldn't have been in Penn Station at 2:30 a.m. preparing for my return trip home same day.
Right.
But of course he is a fan of Patrick Stewart's, as most people are,
right.
And he unfortunately was not in the ensemble in that particular evening, but was the other night when Patrick Stewart actually played in Chicago. But I just like the fact that now he is really embedded in the ISC experience, and I won't spill any beans on other stuff that we've talked about, but it would be neat if some of the things that you discussed and that we sort of fantasized about might come to fruition sometime down the road for the Improvised Shakespeare Company.
Oh yeah, I think, there's nothing is happening on an official level at any degree, but what's definitely happening is his relationship with that group is continuing to grow, and I think he really considers himself part of the ensemble, and we certainly consider him the same, and so he'll play again, I would imagine, someday. And the fun thing that we've now set, the precedent that we've set, is no one knows what he's going to play.
Right.
So twice there have been just like lights up and there he is, and people, from what I can gather from what happened in Chicago, is equal to New York, if not more. The people were just insane, screaming.
I told Martin on Facebook, I was like, what you guys should do on the ISC website is just list him among the players just like he's just like in alphabetical order, just like he's just one of the gang, and
yeah,
you know, don't mention his bio down there. Don't mention X-Men or Star Trek or any of his Shakespearean Royal Shakespeare Company work. Just that's there he is. It's Pat, one of the guys.
Right, yeah, Pat Stewart.
Well, the reason we've convened across our telephonic lines here is actually not to talk about ISC, but we hadn't had a podcast in a while, and I wanted to talk to you about a show that, of course, you and I both enjoy, Mad Men, and we are now 10 episodes into season 6, the second to last season. We got 3 more episodes to go this year, and then presumably somewhere around 13 to 15 next year, and that is, as far as we know, that is it. Matthew Weiner has said it's a 7-year deal, and it's going to be 7 years, and so the story of Don Draper and friends will conclude sometime in 2014, I suppose, if they keep to the same schedule they had the last couple of seasons. So I guess just big picture, let's talk a little bit about what you think of the season so far as a whole, and then we'll get more specifically into what we just saw this past Sunday night.
Yeah, well, with Mad Men, I think I'm pretty forgiving with Mad Men, and certain episodes seem slower or more boring than others, and those usually don't bother me too much. I feel like there's like an idea that Mad Men either has like placeholder episodes which just kind of sit in the place, and you just kind of get maybe a little character exploration, but nothing much happens, and then you have episodes with like major events. Neither one really bothers me. I don't look forward to either one more than the other. So overall for the season, I've enjoyed it. I mean, they plopped it down in 1968, which is going to give them, I do feel like that's a little more present than usual. Mm-hmm. There's a lot more overheard news from behind people, radios and televisions. So they're certainly enjoying that strongly. Sort of a world in crisis, I guess. But overall, I've enjoyed it quite a lot. As far as where it's going, I think that it'll be curious to see how this thing wraps up. And then, of course, where they land next year. Time-wise, what kind of gap they put in there, I think will be interesting. But I think Mad Men is a show that I'm pretty forgiving with, and also probably don't watch as critically as maybe you do. So I may be here to... I don't mean critically as in a critic. I mean actually like parsing it as much and thinking hard about where things might end up. So
I have a couple of responses to that. I think that certainly I've been accused on more than one occasion of being overly critical. I think that I overanalyze things just in general, basically because I probably shouldn't say this, but I have a job that allows for a lot of thinking about other stuff.
Not anymore,
work.
You know. Now that it's out there, you're fired.
Secret's out. So, you know, when I'm at work on Monday morning and I've you know, I watch Mad Men, I go to bed, I get up, I go to work, a lot of my Monday morning is occupied by mulling over and savoring the episode from the night before. So I do think that I do have a tendency to overanalyze, but I also think that I am kind of like you. I am forgiving, and I think that really the only episode that I didn't like this year was the premiere. I thought that the problem with the premiere was there was a lot of yin and no yang, or vice versa. I'm not well versed enough with that philosophical concept to ascribe characteristics to one or the other, but the point is the episode was a little unbalanced because you had Roger in a state of mourning, essentially, and then Don Draper was kind of his usual morose self, and I just felt like it was just too much of that when what makes one of the things that makes Mad Men, I think, a fun show is that there is this fly-by-the-seat-of-your-pants business stuff, personal relationship stuff, certainly with a healthy dose of history and serious, serious dramatic points. But at the same time, there's also this other side of it, and I felt like that was missing from the premiere. The premiere was too, especially for a 2-hour episode. I mean, to have a 2-hour episode that revolved around that, I thought was a bit much. Other than that, I did think that the first part of the season was weaker than the last 5 episodes we've seen. But I really think it's picked up, and I really have enjoyed the last 5. I think that out of the last 5, there have been 4 good episodes that I really enjoyed, and 1 that was enjoyable but weird. That, of course, being the episode where they get I guess it was methamphetamines.
Vitamin meth, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And
I was a big fan of that episode. I appreciate the weird on that show, mainly for the reason that I do feel like the cool thing about Mad Men is it does feel like somebody loves that project and is deliberately doing stuff as opposed to following any kind of formula or bowing to any kind of, like, audience expectations or anything like that. Knowing that, like, it's not... That episode will be strange, but it's not like, now that's where we're going every episode, you know? It's a nice standalone, and it gives, you know, it's not like, wow, amazing, it was a frenetic episode, and they were all so high, and like, what a great stylistic choice, and so novel, but I did think it was cool, and I think the couple elements in there that seemed like they could have been from, like, Twin Peaks, I sort of appreciated that, like, well, that was kind of fun. That's probably not going to happen again anytime soon on that show. It'll be a standalone in the canon of that show later on. When you're like, oh, yeah, Ken Cosgrove did that tap dance. Bizarre. Did that really happen? You know?
I think that kind of comparing that show in certain respects to Lost, not just, I don't mean that episode, I mean just Mad Men to Lost in this respect. I think as much as I loved Lost, and you know how obsessed I became with that show, I always felt like there were certain episodes, and not just in season 3 when they were kind of like, we don't know how long the show's going to go on, so we kind of have to meet out how much of the story we're revealing each week. But even in season 6, I felt like there were episodes where after we watched them, you and I would talk, and I would say something like, you know, they're running out of episodes here, and they're really not moving the ball, so to speak, towards the end zone as much as they should be. I never feel like that with Mad Men. And part of that is, of course, Lost was a standard network show, 22 to 24 episodes. You had more minutes. I mean, flat out, you had more minutes you had to deal with and more episodes. I don't get that feeling with Mad Men. And I think that, you know, one thing you just touched on was, you talk about placeholder episodes. I do think that's a criticism that some people have levied against Mad Men. I personally don't agree with that. I think that Mad Men does a very good job of saying what needs to be said about a particular character or characters in an episode and then kind of moving on from that. If anything, I think Mad Men is at the other end of the spectrum, meaning they almost have it's the plate spinning problem. They almost have too much going on, so you know we have to deal with Betty, but then we don't see her for 3 episodes. And it's like, oh yeah, that's right, Betty's got this deal where Henry is going to move into politics, and now we have to kind of revisit that and go back to that and so on. So one thing I want to talk about, though, in this kind of comes out of the episode that we just discussed. I wish I knew the name of it, but I can't remember the episode title. But the episode where they do get the methamphetamines.
Yeah.
When is in the last 3 seasons, has Don Draper gone more than 2 consecutive episodes without hallucinating, whether he's on drugs or not?
Right.
I feel like at this point, and this is what I wanted to get your take on, I feel like at this point, would it be fair to call Don Draper a high-functioning psychotic?
Well, I think that that's probably something that you could have a field day with. The idea that, I mean, Don Draper's obviously the principal. With all the plates spinning, he's certainly the biggest plate. And you can go episode after episode without seeing anything that happens to, never mind Betty, but even someone like Joan, who's probably a more principal character than Betty is.
Right.
You realize, wow, we haven't seen anything with her in forever. Or even Peggy. You're always going to have some Don development, I think. And so, yeah, he's such a major character. And the longer you spend with him, I mean, I think this season, in my mind, I would divide this season sort of in half, because I felt like at the beginning of the season, it looked like, man, we're not going to get 6 or 7 episodes in before he either kills someone or kills himself.
Right.
But he seems pretty off.
Right.
And I think that fits his, you know, the more you see his background, even though the flashbacks are not my favorite thing, they don't seem to be that great this year. They don't seem to be revelatory as much as just like, yeah, that's kind of what we expected, or that's more of the same.
Correct.
Or you really, I mean, the guy does have a complicated background that would lead to, it's either the result of or would lead to some kind of psychotic rift. And so he's damaged. I think, yeah, he's damaged goods, and he's not, it doesn't seem like the old Don genius is still in effect so much. He's not coming in to save the day all the time either. He's sort of an observer in the new hierarchy of partners, you know? He isn't taking a really active driver's seat role in anything. So it seems like he's becoming either ineffective or more damaged, or he's, I feel like that's, you know, you talk about Lost, I think part of the reason Lost needed to move the ball was there was some idea that at the end of this thing has to totally be explained.
Right.
Where no one's like, someone has to explain in the 60s, or whatever Mad Men is, but if there is some mystery, it is like, what's going to happen with this guy? Can this guy actually function? Or is there something in his backstory still we need to learn? I don't feel like there's probably some major detail we need to learn, but however that guy ends, it doesn't seem reasonable that he would end up healthy or happy. It seems like he's been in a pretty bad skid for a long time.
I just think, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You talked about early in the season, it felt like, well, he's either going to kill himself or something really bad is about to happen to this guy, whether he attacks someone or whatever. But I literally think that he is essentially now psychotic. I think that he has experienced a break with reality to the point where if it were not for his past work, I think that he would be like a homeless guy at this point, because he certainly wouldn't still be employed. I mean, the stuff that he's done this year, just in the course of business, I mean, you know, it's funny. I keep finding myself siding with guys like Pete Campbell who are calling right. Don out on the stuff he's doing, because the stuff he's doing, I'm not even talking about his personal life at this point. The stuff he is doing in business is insane. And not just insane, but if you had a real business that had partners, there's no way that he would be allowed to do the things he has done. I mean, he would have been bought out, fired, whatever right. they had to do to get him out of the business, it would have already happened. And to the other point that you just made, I think at the end of last season, we sort of got the handwriting on the wall of there was a period when Don was the best in the business at tapping into the American psyche. But things have changed, and he doesn't get the country the way he once did, the way he did in 1950 or 1959.
Right.
And I think there's that one scene that I think was pivotal in last season where they've been racking their brains about how to deal with Jaguar, what the slogan's going to be, what's the pitch going to be, what's the campaign going to be. And Ginsberg comes into his office and it has just hit him. And as Ginsberg is giving this sales pitch to Don Draper on what the campaign's going to be, in the background, because it's in Don's office, you see all these awards, and they're all from, you know, 1957, 1958. And you kind of see, in a very not super subtle way, what Don used to have, Ginsberg now has, and Don probably will never have it again. Don still has an eye for polishing the idea and presenting the idea to the client. He still has that gift. But he doesn't have the gift anymore for distilling the American psyche down into an ad campaign or a slogan. And people right. like Ginsberg and this next generation that's coming up are now the standard bearers for that. Which leads me to my other point, which is, speaking about the things he's done this year, the entire business focus of last season, the major business plot line was, we've got to get Jaguar, because if we get a car, that'll put us on the map, blah, blah, blah. And the fact that he not only unilaterally fired Jaguar after he gave that speech to the entire company, but also then initiated a merger with arguably their chief rival without the approval of the partners, again, this stuff just doesn't happen. And I really get the feeling that in terms of where we're going, I just think either Don or Pete will be gone at the end of the season, will be out of the company. And it's looking like Pete. For a while there, I really thought they were going to tease a, you know, Don getting fired. But Pete seems to be the only person who really, and briefly, like for one scene, Joan. But other than that, Pete seems to be the only person who's kind of on board with the idea that Don is a loose cannon who's got to go. And if push comes to shove, obviously, as we saw last week, you know, Pete is going to be the one who gets the boot. So I kind of think that's where we're headed, but I don't know what your thoughts on that.
Yeah, that could be. It's funny that for someone who started the show off as one of the more unlikable characters on television, meaning Pete, just such a like wormy slime ball kind of guy that he is like the voice of reason now, and it's like, wow, that guy is still the same old guy, and I don't think I would like to work with him. But he seems like a pretty reasonable guy. And Don not only doesn't have like the magic, it's like he would also be a terrible guy to hang out with. Like there seems to be nothing really redeemable about him anymore. And I think the only sympathy is that, like, man, he's really damaged. He's bad news. He's a danger to himself. Like, there's such a like menace around him now. You know, I feel like when they had the break in at his apartment, like that lady was such a menacing character.
Yeah.
For being so like ostensibly friendly, made her so much worse. And there's this looming like, now that he doesn't seem to be on a crash course for, you know, I feel like his affair was such a difficult one this time, and so like it looks so dangerous. There seems to be like this kind of air of danger about everything. And now, in the last few episodes, I feel like the focus has been more on the business of the merger and the business of the new partners. That I think there is like some roundhouse that's going to hit in the finale or in the penultimate episode. It'll really be like a wow, a big leveling.
I think that we got a taste this last episode of the fact that the guys from I can't remember the third. The guy who died, I never remember his name, but Cutler and Shaw are the other two.
Beefy.
Yeah, there you go.
It's Jackie Gleason.
Exactly, the great one, as he's known colloquially.
That's right.
I think that. Particularly Cutler, he has a plan, and he's kind of starting to put it into motion. And I think what's going to happen at the end of the season is there are going to be people there's going to be a further cutting down, and some characters that we know are going to be the ones who are on the chopping block. I don't think you bring Duck Phillips back for that one headhunter scene. And you don't pay that off. I mean, that's clearly something is going to happen. I don't think that was just a random conversation that, well, that's the end of that, and status quo at the end of the year. If I had to bet, I would say one character, one of the major characters, meaning one of the, you know, 10 to 12 primary characters, is going to die at the end of the season, and one of the 10 to 12 is going to, or one of the main ones who's in the business, I guess it's now... Mm-hmm. Sterling Cooper and partners, one of the major ones is going to get the boot or leave. Other than Campbell, you know, Harry Crane is another guy who, I mean, he also is kind of he has some moral issues, but at the same time, it's so weird now because we've reached this point in the show where kind of the younger generation who were the wet behind the ears guys when the show first started and were just kind of scared of Don Draper, they've now reached a point where they are sort of the voice of reason. And, you know, Roger's kind of in his own world, and Cooper, of course, is sort of emeritus at this point.
Yeah.
But those guys are like, when Crane is talking about, you guys don't understand how important television is and how much more important it's going to get, and if you don't make me a partner, I'm going to leave. He's at 100% right. And they don't care. They don't even listen. Meanwhile, Don Draper is showing up for a partners meeting that he didn't even know was going on, and within 5 seconds of sitting down, it says, "So are we done?" I mean, he's right. The worst. He's counterproductive to business, and so I think somebody's going to go. Maybe two people are going to go. I think somebody's going to die. I don't know if it's going to be Megan or maybe just Coop kicks the bucket at this point because he's old and they don't really use him as much anymore. But I think there's going to be a death. Well, I don't think it'll be a suicide because I don't think they do that 2 years in a row. But I think one question that's kind of hanging over the whole season that everybody's kind of scratching their head about is Bob Benson, mark, just kind of open-ended. Yeah. What do you think about him?
Yeah, I feel like he's either utterly malicious behind a smile and he's going to be a real problem, or he's just like some model for... I don't know, or he's some kind of cipher. It's just like, he's supposed to symbolize something, if he's supposed to symbolize the kind of, I don't know, he's just like Johnny Gladhand, and seems to be on the up and up. But I feel like there's something dangerous about him. Some skeleton in his closet or some secret. I don't know. What are your thoughts on Bob Benson?
Well, I think by far, even more so, that Don was an enigma in the first season of the show before we kind of got the bits and pieces. But I think Bob Benson is much more mysterious because whereas Don was sort of the classic case of, look, I don't like to talk about my personal business, that kind of guy, Benson just has kind of come out of nowhere. And, you know, whenever I see a character this mysterious, of course, you know, my first guess is time traveler, obviously. but I think, no, but seriously, I think that up until this episode, this past episode, I was anything from, like what you said, like what you see is what you get, and he's just kind of a little bit of a sycophant, but his heart's in the right place, and he really just wants to do well, to he's a CIA agent who's trying to, who's like, you know, shadowing Don Draper because they think he's not who he says he is. I mean, anything from anything in between. But what I think now is, I think there's a decent chance he's gay, but I'm now convinced that whether he's gay or not, I'm convinced that Cutler is gay. And I think that Cutler is interested in Bob, and is maybe going to test the waters, because, of course, in 1968, you have to be pretty careful about who you reveal you're gay to. I think that's where this is going to go, and this could be just as off base as all of my crazy Lost theories that I had about halfway through season 6 that turned out to be 95% wrong. And 95 is a low estimate.
That's right.
But that's where I think it's going. I think the line that Cutler kind of threw out about, you know, my politics are private and we don't really know anything about Cutler, and he's one of the few guys that we haven't kind of seen with a woman, and he does have kind of a little bit of affectation, and just a lot of things that they have, and the way that Harry Hamlin is playing him, I think that's where they're going. But I could be wrong, of course. I could be way off about that. But I think what's going to happen is, there's going to be something between him and Benson, and, you know, maybe Benson turns out to be not gay, but he's kind of faced with this dilemma of, you know, I aim to please, what do I do here? I don't know. Maybe that's just way out in left field. But when I was watching the episode last week, all that stuff was kind of popping in my head because of a lot of different things that were said on that episode. But, you know, we'll see.
Yeah. If it's a different TV show or if it's a movie and Bob Benson's in there, then Bob Benson is definitely a serial killer.
Oh, for sure. Absolutely.
You know, so who knows? I mean, certainly there's something more to him. And I think that would be a disappointment if he just kind of continued as is through the finale.
It's funny because I read something online, and this is a quick tangent because we've been referencing Lost a couple of times. I read some short article online where they were talking about, somebody compared Bob Benson to Nikki and Paolo from Lost.
Oh, uh-huh.
Kind of obviously unfavorably, which I thought was totally unfair because, you know, the big problem with Nikki and Paolo on Lost was, this is a closed system, as we might say in the hard sciences. They're on an island, and whoever was on that plane was on that plane, and whoever wasn't. And right. Especially at that point in the show. And so introducing two characters who were now supposed to have, like, they didn't exist up until now, that was kind of the issue with that. Whereas a business is going to have turnover on a monthly basis.
Yeah.
So I thought that was a fairly cheap shot.
Me too. I think they had that. They reeked of, like, sitcom having a new kid. And I don't feel like Mad Men ever feels like it's anywhere near needing that or making that kind of desperate move.
No.
And I can't imagine anyone at Mad Men would be like, gosh, we gotta stir the pot a little. We need some fresh blood on here. We've exhausted everything with all these people. Like, God, no, there's a lot left to do. So I think he's there. I think it's a deliberate chess piece for some reason.
For sure.
I'm curious.
Absolutely.
You know, coming in, I would have thought, I thought Harry Hamlin was good. When he first popped on, I thought, oh, that's an interesting guest starring role. He probably won't be a big deal. But he's certainly stuck around longer and seems to be growing in status, you know, and making decisions and having opinions. And so, and there is like an element of danger under him, I feel like, or I don't know if danger is the right word, but he, you know, he's got these quirks and this like strange voyeurism in certain certain teams and just kind of sitting back and waiting for things to happen, ready to make the play. Like, he's the guy that comes in and is like, we made a decision. Here's the new name. Like, he's sort of asserting himself in some way.
Well, and one of the things that sort of led me to that theory that I have now, that will, of course, be disproven in about 5 days, is Cutler is Mr. Cool. Even when he's in the face of adversity or something he doesn't like, he's totally calm, cool, and collected. When he's talking bad news, he's smooth, silky smooth. The one time that he has blown up has been when Benson said something during the argument with Ginsburg. And when he was talking to Ginsburg, he was totally calm. Everything was calm. And then Benson said something to Ginsburg like, this is your boss. You have to, you know, show some respect or whatever he said. And that's when he got emotional for the first time ever. And it just, that was just something that occurred to me, was the only human he's ever interacted with in an emotional way who triggered that response is this guy right here. And of course, you know, there's another reading of it where it's like, well, but it was building up during the conversation with Ginsburg, and that was just the explosion. But anyway, I agree 100% with your assessment of both Cutler and Benson. I think that you don't have a character like Benson, and he's just there. It's a Chekhov's gun type situation, if I can use the term from the dramatic arts, where, you know, Benson's the gun hanging on the wall, and unless you're going to use him, you don't put him there, because everybody's looking at him, trying to figure out, you know, what the deal is with this guy who everybody says is weird, but he's really the opposite of weird. And that's the thing that makes him so strange in sort of a roundabout circular way. I mean, he's very un-madman in the way he approaches life. I'll be interested to see where they go with that. I think that just to go back to one point you made before, which I think is very salient, you talked about how Mad Men is definitely not a show that will bring in a new character in a contrived way to kind of shake things up, and that everybody's there for a reason. And I agree, and what I was going to add to that was Mad Men is also really, really good at bringing back minor characters, not even necessarily to give them closure, but just to, in a very untraditional TV way, remind you that, yeah, this is still a world, and they still exist in this world. So even though somebody like Duck Phillips doesn't work for Sterling Cooper anymore, the old Sterling Cooper, of course, he still exists in New York City. He's still there. He's still in the mix. And so, yeah, his path might cross one of these characters at some point. And that's something that I really appreciate about that show, is that most of the time in TV, I don't have to tell you that, once a character's arc is wrapped up, they don't exist anymore. I mean, they disappear from that universe unless they come back for one big guest shot that's based around them. And that's kind of the traditional TV model. Whereas with Mad Men, there is sort of this realistic fluidity to the world that these people inhabit, where you might see somebody pop up again, and you never know. I mean, you might see, God, I can't think of the guy's name, the guy who became a Hare Krishna. He was a regular on the show.
Yeah, him and Bert Peterson.
Right.
Coming back in, and the guy at the Hollywood producer guy this week. He's yep. on before.
Yep, yep. He was
Danny or whatever.
Danny, right. He was Siegel's cousin who married Roger. But yeah, he worked as a copywriter for, you know, I don't know how much it was in show days or whatever, but I think it was a very brief period of time before they had to cut people, and he got cut. But and the other thing I was going to say about, what, especially this year, you know, you were talking about Harry Hamlin, and again, he's been great. He's been really strong. But it's interesting, there have been a couple of times this year when there have been recognizable faces, people that I know, but I have not immediately recognized them in their Mad Men roles. One was Ted McGinley. I mean, it took me, like, the first scene that he was in at the dinner table or whatever, it didn't click for me who that was until a couple of minutes into that scene. I was like, oh, wait, that's Ted McGinley. And then there was another scene. It was very brief. But Alan Havey, are you familiar with Alan Havey?
I don't know.
He was a stand-up. No, he was a stand-up comic and also an actor. He was the guy who everybody thought was going to get late night when David Letterman moved to CBS. This is, of course, going back 20 years now. But he was kind of the guy that industry folks said he's going to be the next late night star or whatever. And obviously, he didn't get it. But he did a bunch of stuff in the 90s, and he was. When Roger and Don are at the airport and they're getting taunted by the guys from the bigger firm about losing VIX,
oh right,
that Alan Havey was the guy who was doing it, and I had no idea until after the fact. Somebody I saw online, somebody had pointed out, oh, that was Alan Havey, and I was like, wow, and I went back and watched it. And I was like, it's just amazing that they can take these people I know and put them in these different environs, and I don't recognize them immediately. But that I think speaks to how complete and total the atmosphere of the show is, which is another, of course, praise of how well they've done in that regard. We're getting close to the end here, but I just want to get your thoughts generally on, we've got three episodes left. Where do you think this thing's headed? Best guess.
Well, I think we've already kind of said it. I think there's going to be some kind of cataclysm. I think we stay, if we end in 68 or early 69, I can't imagine there's a big jump, unless someone really wants to put a moon landing in this season, which I don't think is impossible, but I don't think it's probable. And I think something mortal happens, I'd be surprised if it ends up. I agree with you. I mean, I think I hadn't thought much about that, but it would be surprising if it ended up with this partner list at the end of the season, as they have right now, that all those guys are still in there and partners and contentedly working for that company. And then next year, I think there will be some kind of time jump again. But I think, who knows? I think they have fun with that. Nixon has been a historical constant in some way for the whole series. So I think there will be some jump that ends up somewhere next season in Watergate land, somewhere between 72 and 74.
Oh, wow. You think so? Think that far ahead?
I don't know. Well, I mean, that would be a four-year jump if they jump to...
It's the only problem, and I would actually like that, but the only problem is, how do you deal with Sally? I mean, you can't,
right.
You can't recast that role at this point.
That's
so,
right.
But yeah, I've thought about that too, and I would actually be in favor of that, but for the fact that you have that one almost insurmountable issue.
And here's my theory. Sally dies at the end of the season. Next year is 1974.
It's 1986. Everyone is dead of lung cancer except for
right.
Ken Crosby, yeah. Irvin, Pete Campbell.
Pete Campbell has got his own company.
I think, in broad strokes, best guess for me is, I think either Henry Francis or Megan are dead at the end of the year. And they've been sort of teasing this increasing element of danger just in the world, there's been a lot of stuff. A couple things I've noticed, of course, not only the riots and that stuff and the assassinations, but also, like, now there was a scene like on the balcony between Don and Megan in the last episode where there was a very prominent siren. I mean, to the point where I think they even stopped talking for a while. I think there was a scene earlier in the season, I think the MLK assassination, where, Don has to drive the kids home through some pretty rough neighborhoods, and there's a lot of police activity and fires and stuff like that. And of course, there's the dangerous.
Well, I will say this.
Yeah, go ahead.
It's hard to avoid certain theories because of the internet, and so I don't know how much you know or how much you've seen Urban or witnessed to. There's no reason in hashing it out here because I don't really have all the details, but there is sort of this mild groundswell of opinion based around a couple of photographs and things, what I'm going for here, that have compared. There's a shot from your last episode or the episode before of Megan wearing a specific T-shirt where there's also an old similar photograph with the same T-shirt on Sharon Tate.
Oh, okay.
And so people have started drawing that parallel. Now, I mean, it's not an analogy that holds up one for one, except that they're both actresses.
Right.
But there's some people who feel like that is a, there's foreshadowing in certain choices that say she is the Sharon Tate of this particular world. She's an innocent and something awful is going to happen.
Well, it's interesting because I was thinking more the angle of the doctor finds out that his wife had an affair with Don and he goes upstairs. Right. I was thinking more that kind of thing. But that's an interesting point. I mean, there could be, you know, if Megan in episode 12 says, I've got to go to California to shoot a movie or whatever, then I don't know. Maybe that's a tell. But I was thinking, but that could all be crazy. I mean, one thing that Mad Men has done a great job of, and you referenced this a few minutes ago, just when you think that the show is going to go too crazy, it kind of brings it back to this isn't Breaking Bad. And this isn't Walking Dead. This is a show that's based around a pretty realistic depiction, relatively speaking, of 1960s New York City advertising world. And there's not going to be a lot of people who, you know, get blown up or killed, or unless it happens in Vietnam, you're not going to see a lot of that. And I think the closest that they've come to doing that was, of course, the one moment in the series that I really didn't like, which was the lawnmower thing, which I felt was a deus ex machina that really didn't have to happen. And then the other week when Peggy stabbed Abe. Is that his name?
Yeah.
Okay, because
that was really strange.
That was very weird. I actually thought at first that it was a dream, like it wasn't really happening because it was so out there by Mad Men standards. But the fact is, that was one of those things that, again, I forgave it because I'm like, well, now we can kind of move on from this. We don't have to deal with him anymore and them as a couple, which is probably where we need to be. But yeah, that was a weird one. But anyway, there's been this element of growing danger. I think somebody probably dies, Henry or Megan, most likely, because that's going to lead to a situation where either Don or Betty are single, but not both. And then, you know, Betty is the only woman who really is halfway to understanding this nut job, Don Draper. So what do we do with that? Do we kind of go back to basics in season 7? And do they, you know, wind up as these two broken people who just have each other? And the other part, of course, is, as I said, I think that the agency, there's going to be another shakeup. If there's one thing that's been proven over the last couple of seasons, it's that nothing stays the same at that agency for more than a few months. I mean, as we said, Jaguar was the biggest thing they'd ever done, and then within a couple episodes of the following season, they fired Jaguar. So I think that's going to change. I think they'll tease Don getting forced out, but somebody else will get forced out, whether it's Ted or Pete Campbell or somebody like that. You know, they'll get the boot. And so I think that's where we're going. But been a good conversation. Any final thoughts before we wrap up here?
No, I don't disagree with any of that. I think that all sounds, I think we're kind of saying the same thing. Just specifically fun to see how they play out.
Well, very good. Joey, as always, thank you for joining me. You always provide great insights and great conversation, even when we all wind up on the same page at the end in total agreement. But maybe we'll reconvene after the season is over and kind of reflect at that point and look forward to season 7. And of course, before we know it, we're only a few weeks away from the best show on television returning for the end. And if you think we obsess over Mad Men, you ain't seen nothing yet. Joey, thanks a lot.
That one's sure to have more bangs. That one's going to have a few more bodies and jaw-dropping moments.
Well, that's the thing, is that when you're talking Mad Men, it is the parameters, so to speak, of possible outcomes are restricted by, number one, history, because they do try to kind of stick to history, and number two, the fact that it is a fairly grounded show. Again, compared to something like Walking Dead or Breaking Bad, it's a pretty grounded show, and that's part of the appeal of it, I think. Breaking Bad, almost literally anything could happen on that show.
That's right. So we'll look forward to that. I'll let you do your wrap-up now. I don't want to interrupt again.
Oh, no problem. No problem at all. It's been a pleasure, as always. You're welcome back anytime. This has been our first podcast in quite some time, but we will have to definitely get into it more at the end of Mad Men and the beginning of Breaking Bad in just a few weeks. So thanks, Joey. Much appreciated. Talk to you later.